Hi, this is Tamsin Granger.
And this is Dan Abuhoff.
With Tamsin and Dan read the paper on Wednesday.
April 17th. We just established that.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
So, 2 days after tax day.
Taxes were due and everything.
We handled that.
It's a big week.
I handled that for you. Don't worry about it. We're okay. We're in the clear. We're paying through the nose. But that's what you're supposed to do. It's a big week. But it's nice to get taxes.
I would think a guy with your skills would not be paying through the nose.
We're not really, but okay. It's not. Right. You don't broadcast the fact that you're not paying through
the nose. Well, you just did now. Well, you led me into it. Okay. The secret is out.
It's there was an article, an op-ed piece in the Times saying that literally what the title was, you don't have to take every deduction, and if you're an ethical person, you shouldn't. Because, you know, some deductions, you know, maybe they're not justified and you should give more money to the government, which is unbelievably stupid. I don't want to even get into it because there are a couple of deductions he thinks are on, shaky ground. I don't think he's read the entire tax code. If he did, he'd find that there's a lot of stuff that actually works against him that's also on shaky ground. But you got to read the whole tax code. In any event, he's a sociology professor at Princeton, which is exactly what you'd expect, and we move on. Not an economics
It would be nice
professor.
To think that if you gave more money, it would go to good works.
No. If you convince yourself, just to follow this up, okay? He starts talking about some guy. He knows one person who does this, one person in the world, who's in California, taking his word for it, who makes $500,000 a year and doesn't take certain deductions because this is what he thinks, right? He writes, has been struggling with this, with his family, worrying, you know, debating these deductions, which is also a sad state of affairs. And even this guy, who is the epitome of ethical behavior, can't bring himself not to take the deductions. But the money he saves the deductions, he donates part of it to charity. So there you go.
Well, then it probably gets, does more good.
Good for him. I'm glad he's alerted us all to what he's doing. Right. So, so we had a busy week, as we tend to. We went to New York. We went to a Broadway show, right?
Well, we went to New York because you were going to go to a retirement party.
And I did.
And you did.
That was in the evening, yeah.
And hobnobbing with your old buddies. And we sneaked in a Broadway show. Right. I mean, as long as...
We went on a Sunday afternoon.
One of us is going to New York. Why not both of us?
Exactly.
Why not
we got a hotel.
Do something.
That's right. And so we went in to see Water for Elephants. Which just opened a week or two ago and got a very, very strong review. It was a critic's pick by Jesse Green of the New York Times. And Water for Elephants, it turns out, is based on a novel which was quite successful called Water for Elephants by a woman named Sarah Gruen, who's Canadian, which already has resulted in a movie made in 2011 called Water for Elephants with Reese Witherspoon, which was received on a middling basis, and now a Broadway show. And it is, this is my last line before I hand it over to you. And what it is the story of a struggling circus in the early part, well, in the Depression, I'd say called the 1930s. Sort of the interactions of
it's really the memoirs of a guy who spent a few minutes in the circus.
But there raises issues about, you know, how you know, struggling to make money, people who were abusive, people who weren't abusive, romantic triangle, that sort of thing. So
sounds like a novel.
And it has it does, and it has at its heart an elephant who was shown on the stage in a very creative way, and something, and my best word I can say is puppetry, but it's probably a better word. But let me stop. What did you think?
What did I think?
What did you think, honey?
I enjoyed it. We went because I had read the book.
I didn't know that. You held out on me.
Yeah.
You didn't tell me you read the book.
Yeah, everybody read the book.
It was a popular book.
I didn't remember much about the book, but I remembered, basically enjoying it. And, you know, I mean, that doesn't matter. There are a lot of good books in the world. They don't necessarily make good musicals. But what the review said was basically that the, you know, circus acts are pretty spectacular.
Yeah.
And they do help to tell the story. They do actually, they set the scene, but they also move the action to some extent.
Right.
And that it was worth seeing. You don't, again, you don't come out with any, you know, humming any songs.
Well, it didn't say that, but that you're absolutely correct about that.
I'm switching now to my assessment.
Right.
But there's no bow to doubt it that the circus performers were terrific. And the puppetry was rather good as well. You know, not a huge amount. But you know, there was the elephant. There were some other creatures. There was a wonderful
horse. Yeah.
And that was all great. And it intertwined with decent, you know, decent music.
Right.
Okay, the performances were great. The strong voices, I thought. You didn't think so?
Oh, yeah. I think you've got it. You see it the same way I saw it.
So it was very, it was, you know, an extremely entertaining.
Entertaining, interesting. I wouldn't call it a great musical for the reasons you mentioned. The music was okay. It wasn't really great music. It was okay. And the story is not so amazing. The character is not so amazing. But it's there are a lot of creative elements that mesh together in a very clever way. And it seems like we should have gone to the circus, and that the most impressive thing to me in the whole thing was the acrobatics.
Yeah.
I mean, easily, head and shoulders, the most impressive thing about the show was the acrobatics.
Right.
You agree with that?
Yes, but it's different. I mean, I have been to the circus.
How did it compare?
This was actually a lot more fun.
Was it?
You know, when I think of the circus, you remember like the big trapeze acts and, you know, the high wire stuff.
Yeah.
And this was much more intimate.
Yeah.
So maybe if maybe that's part of the case in the smaller traveling circuses, which I never, you know, I went to a bigger deal kind of homogenized thing, I guess. I don't know. It
might be like that in those Las Vegas shows where they have a lot of aerialists and stuff like that. It might be closer up and
Cirque du Soleil
It was kind of Cirque du Soleil type thing. And maybe that makes an impression because I don't remember. I guess I went to the circus a million years ago and I just remember the dirt. There was a lot of dirt and we were miles away and someone would say, oh, look at that. There's a monkey there.
It was all very distant.
Yeah. And and part of it was being young and short and distant. So this was probably, you know, the very high grade of performance, whereas your local circus, who knows, you know, people riding around on horses.
So I like to think this will travel.
No, this won't travel. You can't stage this. It's an impossible.
You don't think so?
Well, let me tell you where it's not going. It's not going to the Mountain Theater here in Lambertville.
No. But I mean, a national company.
Well, maybe they'll do it. But there's something.
Just saying, okay. Loyal listeners, if you know, get a chance to see this.
You know something?
You might want to see it.
This is the most expensive musical to produce on Broadway. It took them $25 million to put this together. So that's how hard.
Why is that?
For all the reasons we're talking about.
That doesn't make any sense to me.
It may not make sense to you, but it is a fact. Okay?
There was almost no...
It's a fact. And it's $25 million. And it is the most expensive musical on Broadway. And it's not because they're paying high salaries to the performers. It's because of the effects. And I don't know. I don't know what goes into it. But that number tells me it's going to be very hard to put together a traveling circus, if you will. But anyway, it was interesting. It was worth seeing.
It was entertaining. Water for Elephants.
Water for Elephants.
If you're not going to go to the show,
if you're in New York, you can
and you
go.
Didn't read the book, you know, go back and read
the
book.
But you know what's interesting? We kept saying, you know, I wonder if a kid could see this because, you know, circus, you think of children.
There were no children in the theater.
Is that economic?
Zero.
Or does that mean you don't think it's
I don't even know. I'd be curious to know.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not talking about a 3-year-old. I'm talking about, you know, a 10-year-old. But they weren't there. So I don't know.
Yeah. No, they...
Although it was very well received, by the way.
Yeah. So, and at the end, people gave it a standing ovation.
Okay, then you give me a segue. So there's an article in the Times by John McWhorter, who is a professor of linguistics at Columbia. He writes a regular column in the Times, although in his case, regular is about twice a month. And he's usually, he only talks about all kinds of things, but again, his expertise is linguistics. And yet this article is complaining about the fact that there has been grade inflation, if you will, and that every performance on Broadway is met automatically with a standing ovation. And he's not wrong. Right. And he says this, you know, this rubs him the wrong way.
Right? Well, I always wonder about it.
I wonder about it, too. But I don't think I write an article in the Times about it. But I wonder about it. But it's here. It's almost like insulting not to give a standing ovation. As I said, right. It's great inflation.
Well, that's why you do it.
Yeah.
A lot of the time.
It's not worth fighting it. You don't want to be the guy sitting there where everyone's standing and clapping. Because inevitably there are things you liked in the show. And you probably feel the performers did their best and or were very impressive in their own way, even if you didn't think the show was great. So there's nothing really to be gained by, you know, being the Scrooge and not participating in the standing ovation. Forget it. Don't worry about it.
So what's his axe to grind?
He just feels it devalues it doesn't mean anything now. He's right. It doesn't mean anything. Although I will say there's standing ovations and there's standing ovations. I've been involved in standing ovations where people are clapping in a mild, respectful way while they're standing. And I've been involved in standing ovations where people are applauding wildly.
Yeah.
They're different. You can tell the difference. We should tell John McWhorter, you can tell, don't worry about it. Standing or sitting, there are distinctions that can be made. Okay? Yeah. But that's why it doesn't trouble me.
Well, I'm always curious if I'm with you or if I'm with you and Sadie, comes to the end. And,
are we staying? Yeah, I'm
watching. And I'm always waiting to see if you guys hop up.
Well, the other reason you got to hop up is because the person in front of you is hopping up and now you can't see anything.
Right.
You know? So, And sometimes, you know, what often happens is the standing ovation doesn't really arrive until the main players come to take their bows. In other words, the first group is, you know, the people who played, you know, extras or very minor parts or taking their bows. Well, they don't usually merit a standing ovation. So the standing ovation really is only 100% when you get to the last 3, 4, 5 performers. Everybody says, look, these people are knocking themselves out. You know, let's give them.
So I know that we gave Jelly's Last Jam a standing ovation.
Well, that merited a standing ovation.
You know, I mean, I leapt up.
Yeah.
Right.
Right.
But now that we were lukewarm about some other productions, do we not stand up? I mean, we're way up in the mezzanine. Yeah. Not the mezzanine, though, like the lower balcony.
Don't get people the wrong. We're usually in the orchestra, right in the center.
Yeah, in encores.
In the encores.
Encores. We're way up there.
We're in the tickets they gave us. Yeah.
And I think sometimes we don't stand.
I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, look, I don't think it's a big deal either way. The one place I know we didn't stand, I don't think we stood, was when we saw Little Night Music.
No, I think we stood.
Did we? I didn't think anyone in that audience could stand. So I felt, they took place at what was used to call an old age home.
I think we were delighted that it was as good a production it was.
But,
I'm sure we stood.
But you don't want to embarrass the people.
We were sitting three seats behind the director, Daniel.
I understand, but he couldn't see, and people were...
couldn't see?
There was a lot of assisted living going on there at Thames, I don't think we wanted to stand out too much.
To show off? We would be showing off.
We don't want to show off. That's the kind of people in a sense, you don't want to show off by not giving a standing ovation, too.
So we had a good time in New York.
Yes.
And you went out to a do.
Yeah.
I got dinner from Shake Shack.
Which is probably better food. Yeah.
And But the next day, I just want to stick this in because it's another elephant thing.
Yeah.
I went up to the Met.
Yeah.
And popped in to see a couple of exhibitions.
Yeah.
And one of them was called Indian Skies.
Yeah.
And it's the collection of the artist Howard Hodgkin of Indian artwork, paintings,
okay.
Uh-huh. Asian Indian, and with a lot of elephants, a lot of elephants.
Yeah.
And this is not normally my thing, you know,
yeah.
Not familiar. So I can't say it was at the top of my list, except that somebody I met said, I saw this and it was great.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and the bulletin that the Met sends out to the members, had, you know, was all about this exhibition. And I read that, and yeah. I showed the pictures of the elephants mm-hmm. to Pepper and so on. And I found it interesting, but went to the exhibition, life-changing.
Really?
It was terrific.
Funny, because you haven't mentioned it until now. And it
well,
was life-changing.
I did immediately write to Harry.
Oh, okay.
And tell him he's got to go.
Well, I'm glad you're keeping Harry appraised of what's
life-changing. I mean, Harry captured it. You know, one of the interesting things about these Indian artworks is the sort of juxtaposition of some very flat, bright colors.
Yeah.
And sometimes mainly to do with the animals
yeah.
and birds and, you know, and so forth, very sensitive, nuanced depictions of animals and other creatures.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes the portraiture, too, is that way. That juxtaposition of the very flat, bright with the, you know, very natural is really kind of interesting. So there was that. And it was, you know, I looked at things I had seen pictures of in the bulletin.
Yeah.
Again, totally, totally different experience. And there was one wonderful little depiction of a Brahmin feast
yeah.
beset by a fly infestation. And it had all these Brahmins like desperately trying to mm-hmm. eat and brushing away the flies. So there was also this sense of humor.
Mm-hmm.
That was terrific, and that was monochromatic. It wasn't about color, so it was just great. Indian Skies. It's at the Met until June 9th. So I would encourage anybody
okay.
to go through that.
All right. One thing I forgot to mention. You know, we kind of both expressed very limited enthusiasm for the music. The music in Water for Elephants is written it's not credited to a person. It's credited to something called Pigpen Theater Company.
Mm-hmm.
And they're credited with writing the words and the lyrics. And what they are is a group that does folk music. There are seven mm-hmm. performers who attended Carnegie Mellon together and graduated like 2007. And they work on performance and writing songs and once in a while doing theatrical productions. So it's a very kind of odd, you know, it's not like Cole Porter sitting there trying to write these songs. And sort of they're pleasant songs. They're just, in this case, not particularly distinguished. But I've never seen that before. I mean, I don't know if you have, but...
I thought you were going to tell me it was AI.
Well, it could have been. All right, let's go on to the next one. So we saw a movie. We saw a movie called, what's it? Wicked Little Letters. Which is based on a true story in a place called Little Hampton in early 1920s, in which a woman described as a spinster is receiving these letters, which are very harsh and scatological and the like. And imagine how well that's received in a small town in the UK in 1920. It's scandalous. And a person, her neighbor, is this younger woman who is unmarried and has a young child, is accused of writing the letters, and she is arrested and put on trial, which all sounds terribly serious, but it is somewhat serious in terms of potential consequence, but it's played for humor to some extent. It's a character study to some extent. And it's kind of a fun little film. What did you think?
Yeah, it was fun. It was light.
Yeah.
You know, it was, I mean, it was odd because it centered all around swearing. All right.
Right.
And I wouldn't call the woman unmarried so much as single.
I said she's described as a spinster is what I said.
No. The young woman.
Oh. Well, actually, she was unmarried and she was single.
You
know, I don't want to give anything away.
You're doing a spoiler, okay?
Ah, sorry.
You know?
Okay.
But, no, so it was Olivia Colman.
Olivia Colman and Jesse Buckley.
And Olivia Colman's always good.
Right.
Always good.
Right.
So it was nice. It wasn't, it was not life-changing, but it was fun.
Yeah, like Water for Elephants.
I mean, unless, you know, bad language bothers you, then you won't think it's so fun.
But it was kind of funny because it was, the language was so rough and it was being, you know, described and spoken by people in such a repressed society. It was almost comical to hear them say it. And as we noticed, Olivia Colman and Jesse Buckley were together previously in a film called The Lost Daughter, in which Jesse Buckley played the younger version of Olivia Colman's character. That's a more serious film.
Yeah, so they have a good chemistry together.
Yeah, they have a very good chemistry together.
And there were lots of good characters in that
movie. Yeah, it's like a masterpiece theater, but maybe 20% better, you know. And
right.
So it was, you know, it was good. It was good.
Wicked Little Letters.
There you go. All right. I don't know why I stuck this so early. Yeah, there was an article that said that customers are flocking to Costco to buy gold. People, you can go to buy gold bars at Costco, as the Times says, alongside its $1.50 hot dog and soda combo and gallon tubs of mayonnaise and value packs of socks. Costco has been selling gold bars since October, which is
there anything Costco can't do?
Well, I mean, first of all, I go to Costco more than you do because I like to buy certain things, right? And
because you like big things.
And it's not the kind of crowd that you think is necessarily that's investing in gold. It's looking to diversify their investments and saying, you know what I need? I need precious metals because I have too much money in the market generally. And the way it's set up is everyone is wheeling around the only kind of supermarket cart they have, which is huge. Because it's a
because you're going to buy huge things.
Right. So you're wheeling this thing that looks like a station wagon. And
do they say how they sell the gold?
Yeah,
the gold?
Yeah. It said that you go, you buy the gold bar. I don't know where you buy them. I don't know in which aisle it's in. But what Costco?
I wouldn't think you can just walk in and load up your cart.
You can.
No, I don't think so.
You can.
I think you got to go to a special window or
there's a special
to a back door and load up your truck.
What Costco's famous for
is
rearranging the store every week so that everything's in a different place. So you're always wheeling around. You don't know where the heck anything is. And probably near the hearing aids or something like that, they've got gold bars. But the idea, and the other thing about Costco is you're self-checkout. Okay. So you're wheeling this thing up, all right?
I get it.
In this thing, and you've got the barcode thing. You're going to put the gold bar up there.
How many of these did I have? Three, four?
You got this huge thing of strawberries. You know, and you'd like to think that the guys running Costco are watching to make sure everything is barcoded correctly so, you know, they don't lose it. There's real money at stake. And they do check you on the way out, so they have a little
screen. Right, well, that's the thing. Even if you get through, you know, paying for three gold bars
instead of four. Can you imagine you're waiting online? The guy in front of you.
The guy says, wait a minute.
You're trying to get to the front. The guy in front of you is like 12 gold bars. You're going, oh, my God, he can't get the barcode and the gold bar. I'm going to be here forever. And, you know, he runs up a bill. You know, your bill is $34.37, and his bill is $2,454. I mean, it doesn't make any sense. But, you know, there you go. I have no comment on it except to make the observation that Costco, as you said, sells everything. It all comes back to Costco. Nothing is out of Costco's reach.
Yeah. No kidding.
It's the great American experiment. Go ahead.
Well,
Take us out of the country.
I'm always attracted to Australian stories.
Oh,
since we have Australian neighbors now.
I said Australian. I know where that was going. But yes.
So I zeroed in on as a story about Australia's problem with feral cats, right?
Yeah.
Cats are not native to Australia.
Oh, I didn't know.
They arrived in the 18th century.
I don't think anything's
with
native
Europeans.
To Australia.
A lot of bad stuff came with the Europeans in the 18th century, okay?
Yeah.
And they have all these feral cats,
yeah.
And since the cats and the Europeans arrived in the late 18th century, Australia has lost like 34 species of native mammals. They've gone extinct.
Because the cats.
It's one of the highest rates of extinction for a continent or whatever.
The cats are taking them out?
Well, it's not. The cats. They're. No. The cats aren't doing all of them. Just saying, you know, throwing out this number.
Okay.
That it's a real problem.
Right.
Extinction's a problem in Australia.
Yeah.
And so this story zeroed in on. Mostly a reserve, the Arid Reserve, which protects, gives a haven to bilbies and burrowing bittongs, okay, which are small, endangered marsupials.
Okay.
Kangaroos. Trying to keep them away. Yeah, very good.
Thank you.
In fact, they say the bittongs...
Yeah.
Bittongs, I don't know how you say it, are like, they're like small, hopping, heavyset rats.
Great.
And they seem kind of cute.
Yeah.
Anyway, so they are trying to, you know, they've been going, they've been facing extinction.
Right.
So they're trying to protect them.
Mm-hmm.
And one of their enemies is the feral cat.
Right.
So there have been all kinds of, they've been doing studies. They've been trying to figure out what do we do about this?
Mm-hmm.
Because even, so there are a couple different camps.
Mm-hmm.
One is, let's just kill all the feral cats.
Yeah.
All right. Not everybody goes for that.
Oh.
And partly because you can kill them, there still may be other issues, all right?
Right.
You know, so, and the other idea is to retrain. So on the one hand, you're trying to monitor the cats and which cats are killing the bilbies and the bittongs.
Right.
And you know, and so on and so forth. Turns out, it's not all the cats. It's a subset of larger male cats. But the other problem is the bittongs don't know how to deal with predators. They're called prey. It's a prey naivete.
Yeah.
So they're thinking if they could retrain these little marsupials to defend themselves or to escape or know what to do in a bad situation, maybe that would work. That seems improbable, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And well, they have tried these setups with cats and, you know, the marsupials, and they've noticed that actually what happens is, you know, some of the bittongs get killed, but they also seem to develop. They seem to evolve into having, you know, larger heads and hands or something like that to maybe to defend themselves. So maybe evolution will take care of this. But they're doing this from all different ways. They, for one thing, cats, they find that the cats are reluctant, too smart to like go into a cage. Have you seen the traps we used to set for the groundhogs? The have a heart trap?
Right.
You know, you put an apple inside, the groundhog goes in to get it, and then the door comes down.
Yeah.
He triggers the door. So cats are apparently too smart for that. They're not going in there. Forget about it.
Right.
All right. But the one thing they have come up with is cats always want to clean themselves. They're always busy. You've seen cats do that, right? Like licking their fur and their paws and everything like that. So they've invented a thing called the Felixer. And what that does is spray toxic gel onto cats when they're going by.
Yeah.
They're solar powered, right? And in one thing, they managed to kill 33 cats. I'm sad for the cats, but 33 doesn't seem especially helpful if this is such a big, huge problem.
Right.
All right. They also have sharpshooters. You know, they've got a variety of ideas going on. So that's the feral cat situation. It's not that the feral cats are villains, but they are hunters, and they're, you know, a real threat to these cute little animals. Other animal that's having a problem in Australia is the koala. Not good, right? We all love koalas, all right?
Yeah.
And there are some, it's hard to tell how many koalas are out there, but some people are guessing the population has gone down like 80%. And the cause is chlamydia.
Okay, well, that's sad.
Yes, it's very sad. What do you do about that? Because the chlamydia even, you know, can have a lot of bad results, including infertility. So they've come up with a really good vaccine.
Yeah.
But the problem is it takes two shots. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's hard to, and, you know, then the shots have to be delayed from each other. So the problem is getting the koalas back for another shot, but they've been working on an implant that will, like a time release implant, that they can give them the first shot, give them the implant will release, you know, at the proper time, and maybe that will work. So they're doing that. The other thing they've come up with is drones. I don't think that really, it's not a prophylactic thing, but they think that by using drones to keep better track of the populations, they'll have more information, they'll be able to do better things. And the other thing is having an app.
Okay.
That if they can put ear tags
yeah.
on the koalas and, you know, and follow them, and tell people what they're doing, and people have the app and can follow a particular koala's life, and they'll have an attachment to the koalas, be more concerned, and this will, I guess, finance more help. So that's Australia.
Yeah, it's okay. All right, what else?
What else? We noticed stories about Bogota. And Bogota is famous as being a bicycle city.
Right.
Millions of cyclists, apparently. And yet it's getting more, lately it's been a real issue safety-wise. People are being attacked on bikes, the bikes are being stolen, people are being robbed, etc. It's gotten fairly dangerous. They need the bikes. You need the bikes for transportation because, you know, when we were down there, we could see traffic is right. terrible. So since the traffic's so terrible, public transportation like buses, they don't have a subway. So your only public transportation is really the bus system. And it takes hours to get not very far at all. So that's a big cause for concern. I guess they're just trying to, you know, figure out how to deal with that. And then finally, you know, Sadie and I are planning a trip mm-hmm. to... Stockholm and Copenhagen.
Yeah.
And I just read that the Copenhagen Stock Exchange, the old stock exchange, just burned down. It's built in 1625.
Is that something you were planning on seeing?
I'm sure it was on the list. It's got this very famous tower.
Yeah.
There's these four dragons and their tails twist up to become the top of the tower. And there are these three crowns that represent Sweden, Norway, and Denmark.
Yeah.
Right. So
you'll miss it unless that didn't get burned down. I don't really know.
It sounds like it got pretty. The tower was lead.
Yeah.
So it sounds like it probably just melted down.
You're not canceling the trip, are you?
But there was a lot of artwork in there also,
yeah.
And they had to. Renovations were being done, and then you know somebody noticed this fire in the copper roofing that was being worked on. And I think they managed to get most of the important artwork out. Some of it was very big. You know those big style northern paintings with you know all the famous people in them kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So it took something to get them out. But so they called it, they said, it's our Notre Dame.
All right. That's too bad. All right, so I have something that's European, which is called an article at the time. $0 admission, it just might pay off. So there's a soccer team in France, and I don't understand soccer or football, U.S. or European, but I know that from Ted Lasso that there are various levels, divisions, if you will, and this is sort of a second or third tier soccer team, if I can use that term. So they don't draw very much, and they decided that they would charge $0 admission in most states. And believe it or not, that's increased attendance substantially. So why would they use such a strategy? Well, apparently there's a team in similarly situated in Germany which did the same thing. And there are legitimate reasons. I mean, one is that you sell more concessions. Another is that you cultivate a better relationship with the local governing forces such that they might improve the stadium or something like that. You have that going for you. But also because you just make it, you cultivate a number of fans who over years will support the team even more significantly, perhaps by paying admission. And on top of that, you set yourself up for potential television revenues because the spectators are part of the show. I mean, it's much easier to generate enthusiasm for a television broadcast of a sporting event if you've got 20,000 people in the stands cheering like crazy for everything that happens as opposed to 1,500 people who are indifferent to what's going on, or even if they're excited, it's just 1,500 people. So the article points out that people with sports teams are beginning to realize that spectators are part of the show, and it's not that important to charge them money. If in fact
it really isn't. It doesn't.
They've lost $1 million to the French team because they didn't charge money. But on the other hand, they set themselves up for a television contract that will be worth it. And over time, again, they might grow the popularity of the team. So I'm not advocating this as a necessarily a good solution in all situations. But you just, you know, not every sport at every level draws. And you have to use some kind of a creative approach to build a league, to build something that becomes more of a television. And it's just kind of broad thinking. I mean, I found myself thinking about it because there was the little bit of a hubbub about Caitlin Clark. Did you see that?
Yeah.
And, you know, it showed how much she was going to be paid as a first-year player in the WNBA.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you saw that controversy. And Hoda Kotb, I think that's the way her name is pronounced, of the Today Show, expressed horror. How unfair this is, how awful this is. She's only going to get X $100,000, whatever it is, as opposed to NBA players who get, let's say, $10 million or $15 million, whatever mm-hmm. the equivalent, they get much more. And I'm saying, you know, it's unfair. I'm saying to myself, unfair? What is unfair? What is that even, what does that word have to do with anything? I mean, it's just a market-driven system. Whatever, you know, Caitlin Clark is going to be paid, reflects what demand is for the sport, reflects what kind of the television ratings they get, reflect what people are willing to pay to go to the games, because their attendance is. It's a completely different thing in many ways. I mean, they only play 40 games a year. It's a completely different thing. But for Hoda Kotb to say that, I mean, what is Hoda Kotb, what's she getting? $3 million a year? And there's probably some woman who's just as, you know, reasonably good, who's out in St. Louis, Missouri, who's been doing this for 25 years, who might be getting $80,000 a year.
All right.
So it's kind of
nice. I'm glad you got this off your chest.
Well, it bothered me. I'll just say this, and you won't like this, because who weighed in on this but Joe Biden, of course. I'm not saying I wouldn't vote for Joe Biden for president, but he too says she's not getting her fair share. Caitlin Clark's not getting her fair share. I mean, somebody must know some economics at the White House. I'll leave it at that. All right. The other article I was going to comment on briefly was crossword puzzles.
You don't think it just is...
What?
Is it...
What?
But think of it just more globally.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's just the fair share part of it is here's a person doing at the top of their game.
Right.
All right. Doing the best that they can,
right,
and is the best,
right?
Okay, but no matter what she does, she and you know, she's not going to ever get as much money,
right,
as guys who do their best.
Right.
And it's just because she's...
Tamsin, there are 40 shows on Broadway. There are people, they're raking it in. Merrily We Roll Along. They're charging $500 a ticket. There are other shows that will go to business in 2 weeks. Everybody's doing the best they can. All right? Some are going to succeed, some aren't. Some will have people who are willing to pay. Some people won't. They're all doing the best they can. All right. It's not a, it doesn't work. The market system doesn't work based on, isn't it fair, you know, that these people are getting paid so much and these other people aren't?
Well, unless you're, you know, it's just purely.
She's in a different sport. Women's basketball is a different sport from men's basketball. Okay. It has a different amount of games. They charge different prices. They charge, you know, they have different sponsorship. It's different. It could develop. It could develop. They could, you know, use radical approaches like zero admission.
No, when you're a little kid, you know, you have your parents, your grandparents, your teachers. Everybody's telling you you can be anything you want to be.
Sure.
All right?
You can.
But you can't.
Yes, you can.
Obviously, you can't.
No, you just won't get paid. You can be anything you want to be. Look, let me tell you something. If Caitlin Clark was good enough, she could play in the NBA. All right? There's nothing stopping her. All right? She can play in the men's league if she's good enough. Sure. She's not. So what are you going to do? You know?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying what people deserve. Okay? Neither should Hannah Copy. It's not about what people deserve. It's just the free market economy. Mm-hmm. It's what people are willing to pay for. When you say, be it Hannah Copy or Joe Biden, whoever, says this person's not getting paid enough, what you're saying is, American people are not supporting the sport to the extent that they should be supporting the sport. American people should be going to the games, driving the price of the tickets up. American people should be watching it on television, driving the compensation for the television packages. The American people are failing the WNBA because they're not supporting it. That's all you're saying.
Okay.
So if that's what they want to say, fine. It's on the American people. Crossword puzzles, all right? I mean, this is only interesting to me because it turns out that Simon & Schuster, the great publishing house, which they were celebrating for the 100th anniversary this year in Manhattan, started out, their first book was crossword puzzles. That was their first hit book. And they were skeptical, of course, and they thought it was low grade, and they put a different name on it.
Right, they didn't even use their own names on the company.
They came up with the Plaza Publishing Company because they were embarrassed and ashamed.
They thought it was just, you know, a fad, a crazy fad.
Right, and they kind of, and they said it became more popular than Yes, We Have No Bananas, which is...
which is funny. We were singing that the other day.
Yes, I know.
One of the kids said, is that a real song?
Yeah, Nico asked, is that a real song?
Yeah.
It was big. It was big, but crossword puzzles have stayed around. But the funny thing is that the woman behind it, now I'm going to blink on her name. Petherbridge is her name. Petherbridge, yes. Margaret Petherbridge. She was the woman that they brought in to edit the crossword puzzles. She had been working at the New York World with some paper. She said, I'll come up with 50 puzzles. She got the puzzles and became the leader of the book, the person who was essentially the author. Huge craze. Well, this woman... Very interesting woman. Margaret Petherbridge later marries John Farrar. All right? She becomes Margaret
And they
Farrar.
End up with the...
Here's the funny thing. So she takes her crossword puzzles to Farrar. Farrar turns out is a publisher, and the crossword puzzles help him establish his own publishing house. And his own publishing house is Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, which is a huge publishing house. So this woman started two publishing houses. I mean,
Also, she's responsible for setting down most of the basic rules and regulations designed the whole format, kind of thing.
The whole thing's her.
Right.
These are huge businesses that have existed for decades because she's doing these crossword puzzles. It's amazing. All right. So finally, there was an article that just interested us, but I don't know where it takes you in particular. Which is an article, Some Words Feel Truer in Spanish, which is written by a woman named Natalia Sylvester, who it sounds like grew up in Florida. And she's talking about the back and forth of speaking English and speaking Spanish. Her parents apparently spoke Spanish, and they spoke Spanish.
Well, her family was from Peru.
Right. Yeah. And then, but in school, of course, was English. And it became a back and forth with her parents. It would be like, how do you say this? It was como se dice, you know, birthday party or something. Or they give you the Spanish version. She'd give, you know, how do you say Feliz Navidad? She would say it's Merry Christmas. And so she was translating for her mother.
Actually, her mother was helping her learn.
Right. Okay.
And English, she wanted her trying to help her keep up the Spanish.
Right.
Yeah, they were. So what's your point?
My point is, Hazi is doing the same thing.
That's
Haz Bone is doing the same thing. And
right.
All to the good.
Yeah.
So they call it, what do they call it? Coding or something like that? They have a phrase.
Code switching.
Code switching. It's the mental process by which you think about something, you think about it in one language and another language, and he's doing it at a very
well. Also, switching into the other languages for certain people in certain situations,
right?
Which we were talking about with his abuelo,
right? And Nico's it's fun
father.
Dealing with Ozzy, who, let's face it, he's two. He's not, you know, he has only a limited amount of language as it is. And sometimes it's Spanish and sometimes it's English. And you can see him working back and forth. And what's brilliant about it is, and I understand it's true, when he talks to his abuelo, let's say, he'll talk in Spanish. And when he talks to us, he'll talk in English. No one has to tell him to switch. And he will just instantly, you know, Spanish, English, because he knows.
He laughs. If I switch to Spanish numbers or something,
yeah.
he gives him a chuckle. What, you? Saying that?
Yeah. You have no idea what you're talking about. So it's kind of interesting. Okay, we should wind it up. I think that's plenty. All right?
Right.
And I hear the kitchen buzzer going off.
Yeah. I got stuff in the oven. So this is Tamsin Granger.
And this is Dan Abuhoff.
And we'll be back next week with Tamsin and Dan Read the Paper.